Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We begin today's show by discussing coverage of the historic demonstrations and protests in Puerto Rico, which forced Governor Ricardo Rosello to resign. More than 500,000 people filled the streets after the Puerto Rican Center for Investigative Journalism published sexist and homophobic text messages between the governor and his inner circle. Rosello mocked victims of Hurricane Maria. The Center for Investigative Journalism also reports that amid the worst fiscal crisis in Puerto Rico's modern history, the island is the target of a pillage of public funds perpetrated through the sale of influences, contracts, and access to benefits in the government. In his recent piece in The Nation, today's guest, journalist and writer Ed Morales, writes, quote, "The crass attacks on women and marginalized groups have obscured the revelations of political scandal, fraud, money laundering, and the misuse of government funds." Ed Morales is a journalist and author of Latinx, The New Force in American Politics and Culture. His forthcoming book, Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico, will be published in September. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how's it going out there in the Bay?
It's pretty good. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Well, as we always do on our media roundtable, we'd like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. And I know that you've been consumed with Puerto Rico. So where have you seen good coverage about what's happening in Puerto Rico?
Well, certainly what the Center for Investigative Journalism has been doing in Puerto Rico for a long time. The Intercept had a great story by Kate Aronoff the other day. You know, I think the Times coverage has been really good, particularly Francis Robles. They've been getting both the human side of the story and, you know, some of these nasty details as well.
Let's just talk for a minute about the Center for Investigative Journalism. This is the group that actually released the text messages. And I spent some time on their website last night and this morning, and they do really incredible investigative reporting. One of the pieces that's really long that is directly connected to this and yet is not getting that much attention, maybe outside of the independent media, is called "The Pillage of Public Funds in Puerto Rico Going On Behind the Chat." And they report, amid the worst fiscal crisis in its modern history, Puerto Rico is the target of a pillage of public funds perpetrated through the sale of influences, contracts, and access to benefits in the government.
Right. Well, they uncovered various details about not only the improper, granting of contracts without a proper bidding process, but also pressure that was placed on various administration leaders or heads of departments to go with contracts that were favorable to this one person that kept popping up in this whole story. His name is Elias Sanchez, who is very close friends with Ricardo Rosello. In fact, Rosello was the best man at his wedding. And also, Elias Sanchez was in the chats. I mean, that in itself may have pointed to some ethical violations, because at the time he was not contracted by the government, and so he was in on all these conversations that had to do directly with government business.
Let's just talk about the significance of these massive strikes, Ed. The Washington Post has a piece by Lilian Rivera, who lives in Puerto Rico. The headline
is... Sure, she's a friend of mine.
No, she's a friend of yours, okay. What Puerto Rico's protesters can teach the rest of us. And then there's a piece in Common Dreams by Julia Connolly, "Need a Blueprint to Remove Trump? Look at what Puerto Ricans did in just 16 days. Can we just talk about the significance of these massive protests and how you think those specifically, the protests and just the determination of the people, has been covered in the media?
I think that the media has been doing a decent job on showing how it's a diverse group of demonstrators. They've been focusing a lot on younger people, but also showing how there's all these cultural activities. And I think that it's really important to understand that it's kind of like a new form of nationalism that's happening in Puerto Rico. One of the reasons why it's so successful is that people just feel loyalty to, you know, what in Spanish we call la patria, or the homeland of Puerto Rico. And so it's a really strong nationalism that has now adopted all of these sort of progressive values, like supporting women, you know, fighting against violence against women, supporting gay and trans people, and even supporting Afro-Puerto Rican cultural traditions. And it's because people view Puerto Rico there as a nation as having been held captive for 500 years, because originally it was a colony of Spain, and then it went directly to be a colony of the United States. So it brings up a lot of passion, but it's also been kind of expansive in that it's been able to absorb all these new, I don't know, agendas that have not really been part of the traditional culture of Puerto Rico.
You spoke to Juan Carlos Rivera Ramos. He's an activist in Puerto Rico. And you were talking with him just about the diversity of the demonstrators. You write that the staggering diversity has elicited fresh declarations of the slogan, Puerto Rico is waking up. And this is a phrase that was previously used as a rallying cry for fundraising in the wake of Hurricane Maria, but it lost its luster as the difficult realities of recovery set in. And Juan Carlos Rivera Ramos told you, quote, "We're writing history. Our people and all their diversity of colors and flavors, ideological plurality, are expressing dignity on the streets. My eyes are tearing," end quote.
Yeah, well, actually, I just talked to Juan Carlos again this morning for a new piece that I'm writing for The Nation, and he is involved with an organization called Junta Gente, which brings together a lot of different organizations to, their goal has been really to create a resistance against the disaster capitalism that's been happening in Puerto Rico, where outside economic interests are buying up a lot of land and property and not necessarily concerned with the fate of the average Puerto Rican. So Juan Carlos is involved with a lot of student activists and labor groups and university professors, but at the same time, he stressed that it was a remarkable protest because for the first time in a while, a lot of people have been coming from the public housing projects, which are called caseríos or residenciales. There's the famous Ray Charlie, who was a guy who was a social media organizer who organized this huge cavalcade of motorcycles and four-track vehicles to come to San Juan. And, you know, usually in the past, like, the demonstrations have been dominated by sort of the intelligentsia and the labor unions, but it's become a much more popular, widespread sentiment. And that also is due to the involvement of all these popular music figures like Residente from Calle 13 and Bad Bunny and Ricky Martin.
Ed, can you give us some context here? You talked about disaster capitalism. For people who maybe don't know about what the island is actually going through economically, can you give us some information about that? In your piece for The Nation, you write that the island is suffering the worst political and economic crisis in its history, 4 years after its previous governor, Alejandro García Padilla, declared its $72 billion debt unpayable, resulting in the creation of a fiscal oversight and management board a year later to restructure that debt.
Right. Well, I mean, that's since we're talking about media, I mean, I think that that hasn't been stressed enough, the what's been happening in Puerto Rico since the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board came into being at the beginning of 2017 after the law passed in the summer of 2016. And that is that, you know, one of the reasons for this whole thing happening is because the Puerto Rico government has been reduced to sort of this advisory board. I mean, they do have to come up with these economic plans, but they have to be approved by the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board you know, which is an unelected group of people who most of them come from the financial sector. It's almost like a technocratic takeover of the island. And so, in a sense, you know, I'm not trying to create sympathy for the Rosselló administration, but they're sort of reduced to sort of playing this theatrical role of trying to defend the people's interests. You know, in fact, they were trying to defend against pensions being cut. But in the end, they just always sort of went along with the what the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board suggested in terms of austerity and cutting budget and cutting pensions. So in terms of disaster capitalism, after Hurricane Maria, a lot of, you know, the most famous case was the Whitefish case, where this Whitefish Energy people from Montana who had these connections through the secretary that Trump imposed, I forget what, maybe Interior. And the Rosselló administration sort of looked away while this relatively inexperienced group was contracted to rewire a lot of the electrical grid. So that's one example of disaster capitalism. Another one is the way that the Secretary of Education used, and this is very similar to what happened in New Orleans, by the way, used the impact of the hurricane to justify closing a lot of schools and starting this experiment to implement charter schools on the island. And she's the one, was one of the people who was arrested 2 weeks before the revelations of the chat. It was really sort of the beginning of this whole crisis period.
Today we are speaking with Ed Morales, journalist and author of the forthcoming book, Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. It'll be published in September. And we're talking about media coverage of the historic demonstrations in Puerto Rico, which forced Governor Ricardo Rosselló to resign on Wednesday night. And if you have any questions or comments for Ed, if you have any thoughts about the media coverage that you've been hearing and seeing over the last couple of weeks, we'd love to hear from you. Have you been reading and hearing about the political corruption? Of course, the texts are very important, and what we learned are just horrific. Rosselló calling a female politician, sorry to say this, a whore, and mocked victims of Hurricane Maria. That's getting a lot of attention, which is warranted. But what about the political corruption? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ed, you have this book coming out next month, which people can start pre-ordering now, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. It's called Fantasy Island. Did you uncover anything new? I mean, what did you uncover in the book that has not been reported in the media, specifically about exploitation and the betrayal of Puerto Rico?
Well, most of what are revelations in the book come from its historical investigation of the ties between lobbyists from Puerto Rico and members of Congress. And as far as what happened post-Maria, most of the reports are based on established reporting. What's new really is understanding these deep historical ties to that you know, that people would not expect, like sort of the involvement of the Democratic Party with the pro-statehood group, which is actually the pro-statehood party, which is really behind that chat, the text, the insult that you just mentioned towards the former speaker of the city council in New York, Melissa Mark Viverito. What she was actually doing was complaining that Tom Perez, who is the head of the Democratic National Committee, had been openly declaring his support for statehood, and she was saying that there should be more of an opening in the DNC for people who were not in favor of statehood, that maybe were in favor of independence or the current Commonwealth status. And that's one of the reasons she was attacked, because there was a revelation in Ryan Grimm's book that was also reported on by David Dayan in The American Prospect, about how Tom Perez seemed to have benefited from this block of people from the New Progressive Party, which is ironically named, who had pushed his candidacy, and that's one of the reasons he won. So there's a lot of strange ties that have gone on between the political parties in Puerto Rico and the Democratic Party in Washington, which is not what people usually think, because the pro-statehood party in Puerto Rico tends to be more socially conservative, which is not exactly. The other thing that I talk about a lot is the parallels between New York's fiscal crisis in the 1970s and what happened in Puerto Rico. And I also tell a little bit about my own life story, because I was growing up around that time. There's surprisingly similar things happened.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I've just been so impressed with the number of people in Puerto Rico who have, you know, protested and how much this has accomplished. And I've just been musing over the idea that, you know, Trump is a million times worse than the governor of Puerto Rico. And you know, why can't something like that happen here? I mean, you know, at 500,000 people in Puerto Rico, you know, we could do something like that here and get rid of Trump without the problem of impeachment. And I just don't know, you know, why this isn't or can't happen.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Ed, actually, one of our listeners sent me a story from the World Socialist website called The Mass Protest in Puerto Rico. And they pointed out that it's a great piece. They pointed out that even the low end figure, 500,000, would mean 16% of the territory's population of 3.2 million protested on Monday. That would equal about 50 million protesters here in the United States.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of factors involved. I think, you know, one big factor is, as I said before, there's a national unity about, you know, an emotional support of Puerto Rico that comes from identifying with a place that has been a colony for 500 years. So you don't get that same kind of burst of national, you know, unfortunately here in the U.S., nationalism has been associated more with militaristic things and even now, you know, the white supremacy. But the other thing is, as well, is that, you know, one of the biggest reasons why there's such a mass outpouring of emotion about this is because people went through such a terrible time during the hurricane. Mm-hmm. And so many people went through very difficult circumstances, you know, not having electricity or water for months, being worried about elderly relatives who may not get the right, you know, health care. So, I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to make excuses, you know, in the U.S. should have more political activism. But that common experience of real deep stress, I think, is what really got a lot of people out onto the streets.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Nancy. And let's remind listeners, we talk about Hurricane Maria and Irma. They left thousands of people dead. 5,000 people died, right?
Yes.
I mean, this is a massive number.
Well, I mean, the biggest number supposedly reported is 4,645 that the Harvard study did. And not everyone agrees that that's the right number, but, you know, I'm not going to say that it's unrealistic. I'm sure it's very possible.
And the piece that I cited points out, and it just, things go so fast that you forget what happened even yesterday in some cases, but they remind us that when the hurricane struck, the federal and local governments lied to the population about the death toll and refused to make any real effort to provide aid. Remember when Trump boasted that the hurricanes were not real catastrophes because they only killed 16 people, and then he was tossing out paper towels to people. The piece also says 10,000 schools, bridges, roads, and other infrastructure were destroyed by the hurricanes. And as of July 24th, only 9 reconstruction projects had been approved by FEMA.
Right. Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of documentation about how much more aid was sent to Texas and Florida and how much quicker it got there, even down to the roof tarps. Well, obviously we know that Trump has been consistently misstating or lying, whatever you want to call it, the amount of money that's been sent to Puerto Rico to, deflect criticism, when it's actually been, very, very much less. And, that's one of the bad things about this whole thing happening is that it's giving the Republicans in the Trump administration excuse to withhold more aid, and also, right now they're already putting more restrictions on this Medicaid package that's supposed to be going, which, is really bad. And, there's a study, too, that came out that about 40% of Puerto Ricans are facing what they call food precarity, which means, not really sure you're getting enough food. Mm. And, those are the food stamp program that is directed at the large percentage of Puerto Ricans that are, at the poverty level, has been decreased. So where people were getting something like $1,200 a month, and now they're getting less than $1,000 a month for food. So all of these things are, terrible effects of the Rosselló government, and the unfortunately it plays into the Trump administration's hands. And then two things I didn't mention before was that both the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal published editorials that called for more involvement or an even more authoritarian presence of the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board.
Hmm. And before we end, Ed, I just want to ask you, what's next for Puerto Rico now that Governor Ricardo Rosselló is resigning? He's going to be replaced by his Justice Secretary, Wanda Vasquez, a former prosecutor who headed the U.S. Territory's Office of Women's Affairs. What can you tell us about her?
Well, she's a controversial figure. Whoever's going to take place of Rosselló is someone from his party, the New Progressive Party or the Pro-Statehood Party. She has been, thought of as someone that has been protecting Rosselló. And also she has a bit of a personal scandal in intervening in the case of one of her relatives. I think it was her nephew who was involved in some kind of minor crime, and she sort of was trying to make it go away. So I don't know if you're going to see Wanda Vasquez as the governor. There's actually the breaking news, or just yesterday I was listening to the Puerto Rico radio, and they were saying that the reason why Rosselló delayed for so long in announcing his resignation was that he was trying to negotiate a deal with the president of the Senate, who is even more to the right than he is, Tomás Rivera Schatz, who would be then named by Rosselló as Secretary of State and then be in the succession order ahead of Wanda Vasquez. And in exchange for that, he would get a full pardon, because there's really deep investigations, FBI, DOJ investigations. And so he denied those claims yesterday. Rosselló did.
And what is your upcoming piece about, Ed?
My upcoming piece is going to talk about the new possibilities for politics in Puerto Rico, where I talk to a lot of leaders of alternative political movements and the possibility of a new political party, because right now all of the parties, the traditional parties, are based on whether they favor a certain kind of status, the present status, the independence or statehood, and so there may be organization of a new political party that would have more of a social justice agenda and not necessarily tied to a certain status.
Well, when your new book comes out, we would love to have you back on to talk about your book and also what is happening in Puerto Rico. Thanks for joining us, Ed.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'd be pleased to come back.
Great. Thank you. Ed Morales is a journalist and author of Latinx, The New Force in American Politics and Culture. And his forthcoming book is Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. It'll be published next month. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Harper's Scott Horton about Robert Mueller's testimony. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. And now we're going to unpack Special Counsel Robert Mueller's testimony in front of two different House committees and talk about how the media reported on the nearly 7 hours of hearings regarding Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and the obstruction of justice case against Donald Trump. Joining us is Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rose.
Great to have you, Scott. Well, you know, there have been report after report and hours of cable news about the optics of Robert Mueller's performance, which we are not going to talk about. I want to ask you a very basic question, Scott, because I just think so much more context is needed in a lot of the reporting I've heard over the last few days. Can you just remind us what this Mueller investigation was all about in the first place?
Well, it was launched out of an FBI counterintelligence investigation that got going in the final months of the presidential campaign in 2016. After the election and Jeff Sessions became Attorney General, it became clear that he had to recuse himself from oversight of the investigation because he figured in it. So he was involved at several key points at which dealings with and information coming from the Russians were discussed within the campaign. So ethics officers inside the Justice Department persuaded him he really couldn't be involved, he had to be outside of it, and that it would make sense to appoint a special counsel, that's what we used to call independent counsel or special prosecutor. And a decision was made to pick Robert Mueller, who was, I guess, one of the longest-serving directors of the FBI, certainly not quite as long as J. Edgar Hoover, but beyond him, I think, the second longest-serving director, and a career prosecutor for many, many years, former senior Department of Justice official, a person whose political affiliations have always been very, very clear. He's a Republican, but who has also never been viewed as particularly political. So he was appointed to handle and run the investigation. The investigation was given a tasking to look into questions whether there were improper or illegal dealings between the Russians and the Trump campaign during the administration, particularly as related to the hacking of materials from the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign. And that's an investigation he managed in, I think, what is now record amount of time. I mean, it was actually completed far more quickly than any of the other major special counsel investigations. And it produced a large number of indictments, 35, significant number of convictions, and so forth.
And some of these convictions and indictments were raised yesterday. And Scott, and I just said this with our last guest, Ed Morales, because there's so much news happening, it's easy to forget some of these things. So can you remind us, of those 35 indictments, which ones really stand out for you?
Well, I would say first of all, you've got seven people who were members of the Trump campaign who were indicted. And the most important, certainly, are Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. After those two, probably the president's national security advisor, Mike Flynn. So you have three, I'd say probably the three most senior figures in the campaign and the campaign's professional staff, and the most important figure on foreign relations questions, all being indicted and all being convicted. In fact, we're still awaiting the sentencing of General Flynn. So those are the most important, and then beyond that, we have a large number of secondary figures in the presidential campaign, and then we've got Russian intelligence officers. We have a large number of other people on the periphery, and we know that it also spun off at least four other significant investigations, which some of which are still going on.
Hmm. Well, Scott, I'm just so glad that we actually have time to bring some context to all of this. Have you read most of the report, the 450 pages of this report?
Yes, I've read it all.
You've read it all.
Beginning to end.
Okay.
And I spent a lot of time going over materials that were redacted, trying to figure out what the redacted materials were about. So I guess, you know, that literally I haven't read every word because, you know, significant pieces of it continue to be about 9%.
Right.
Still blacked out. And as that, we can only guess what they cover. But everything that's been made public, I've read.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. Based on what is missing from the media coverage about what's in the report, and then I'll ask you about the key findings. Did anything stand out for you that's not getting that much attention?
I think the media, I mean, you know, there's been a vast amount of media coverage, and I think some of it has been utterly trivial, but there's also been a good amount of serious coverage. So I don't think there's a significant finding or conclusion in the report that hasn't been covered by the media, but I think it also occurred in two different waves. So we had a first wave of reporting that occurred when the first announcements were made by Attorney General Barr about the report. And that reporting was all based on Barr's characterizations of the report, which turned out to be overwhelmingly false, either mischaracterizations or just blatantly untrue. So there was a first wave of reporting that was really grossly inaccurate. And then after the release came, we had a second wave of reporting, which I think dug in and got it more or less correct. At least I think the major legal affairs reporting done and major broadcast media and print media did get it right.
Well, let's talk about one of the conclusions. Mueller made it clear that Russia had in fact interfered in the U.S. election on Trump's behalf. So over the last few days, I've been hearing this, that Russia interfered in the elections. Based on what you read in the report, Scott, can you give us details? What does that mean exactly?
We still don't know a lot of details because I think that's, you know, some of the redacted portions of it deal with that. But I would say if you go back and look at the hearings that occurred earlier this week, that's the most important takeaway from those hearings. Not just that he found that copiously documented to the extent that there really was no doubt about the existence of a widespread active measures campaign, but also that this campaign has never stopped. It's still going on now, and it's revving up for a major role in the 2020 presidential election as well. What's the evidence that he assembled for that? There's not a tremendous wealth of it in the reports themselves, but if we now step away from the report and we look at the criminal complaint that was filed against the troll farm officers, who are mostly Russian military intelligence officers, in St. Petersburg, I guess a couple of them in Moscow as well, it's pretty clear that he was drawing his conclusions based on work that was done by the American intelligence community and by cooperating foreign intelligence services, particularly, it seems, the Dutch, and that included signals, intercepts, and their own spying work. It seems in particular that the Dutch got actually inside of the troll farm and were able to photograph, get pictures of the individuals who were involved, associate them with the computer account. So that's how they were able to break down and figure out the name. So I think that he was able to establish a good scope of the operation, a large number of the people who were involved in it, what tasks were given to them, and the funding level for the operation. That's all there. And now, incidentally, we also have, after this hearing, immediately after it, the Senate Intelligence Committee releasing its own report on the same subject, which I've also just examined and found that is roughly 70% redacted. Uh-huh. So not a lot of detail, but still, nevertheless, it does make very clear that this is a very large scale Russian operation. It was focused previously on ensuring the election of Donald Trump, but beyond that, it was really designed to try and bring about political chaos in the United States. Try to drive political controversies that were not susceptible of being resolved and would whip people up into a frenzy of anger. And of course, we know that they picked a dozen different issues. There was the Black Lives Matter issue, in which they tried to rile up people on both sides of that, Southern monuments. It was a large number of different issues were selected because of their emotive quality. They would get people angry on both sides, and then they would work on both sides of the issues. And then there was also an effort to destroy people's confidence in the integrity of the elections, to believe that they were fake and they couldn't be relied upon. And of course we know, and Mueller also talked about this, that there was a large-scale operation that was planned for Election Day in 2016 that was designed to create chaos and confusion that would be used to undercut what it seems was expected to be the victory of Hillary Clinton. But, you know, once it was clear that Trump had won the election, they pulled back from that operation.
Today we're speaking with Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And if you have any questions or comments about media coverage of Robert Mueller's testimony and the specifics of the report, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So the report found also that the Trump team welcomed this intervention and that Trump subsequently acted to impede the investigation. And he also said, Mueller said that Trump could be criminally charged after he leaves the White House. This piece of information, Mueller's statement about that, did get a lot of attention, Scott. What do you think about that statement?
Well, it was, you know, in law school, I was taught the 10 commandments of cross-examination, and the first of them is you never ask a question when you don't know what the answer is going to be, because the answer could turn right around and bite you. And that's what happened here, because this was a Republican congressman who asked the question, and he got the answer he really didn't want, which is that the criminal charges could be brought. And I think what Mueller is saying is the received wisdom of legal scholars in the area. And I think, frankly, you know, it raises some very, very powerful questions. So we have, you know, not only the obstruction issue, but we also have the investigation coming out of the Southern District of New York into Michael Cohen that looked at the payoff system for a porn starlet whose narrative was being suppressed awaiting the elections, and the plea bargain agreement and sentencing recommendation documents that were filed in that case both talk about Donald Trump, not by name, but he's given a cover name, as the person who was instructing the conduct of the attorney, in this case, Michael Cohen. So, you know, that creates a strong inference that this person is going to be charged and that the evidence and materials have been collected to charge him. But no charges have been brought, of course, because of the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum. So there are two things we know of right now. I mean, there is that, and there are the obstruction charges, both things that could be brought. We had also a very interesting exchange with Ted Lieu in the course of this about whether his conclusion not to charge on obstruction was driven by the OLC memo. So in the question and answer session, he essentially said, yes, that's right. And then he pulled back to a much more formal position that, no, he didn't actually reach that question. He didn't reach that question because of the OLC memo. So it's sort of a fine distinction. But in any event, I think he left no doubt that in his mind, that charges that the opportunity exists and these charges could be brought as soon as Trump is no longer president.
There was an interview in The New Yorker with Neil Katyal, who helped draft the special counsel regulations during the Clinton administration and was acting solicitor general under Obama. And he said there should be two follow-up questions because Mueller, who is very by the book, has to be asked questions when the book has changed. And the book has changed because Attorney General William Barr in an interview in May with CBS News, said Mueller could not indict, but could have made a determination on whether the conduct constituted obstruction of justice. Neal went on to say, "And so I was shocked that the Democrats did not ask that question and press Mueller on it, because the attorney general himself gave sanction for it and for answering it. I understand why, when Mueller turned in his report, he felt like he couldn't answer that question, but after Barr changed the rule book, he very well could have." What are your thoughts on that, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, I think my friend Neal Katyal was absolutely right about that. I mean, this is one area where he should have been pressed much more aggressively for answers. And I think that's also what Ted Lieu was trying to do, was trying to get his answer. And I think he thought that he had an affirmative answer on that, and then it was halfway walked back. And Congressman Lieu later posted a tweet in which he said, you know, imagine that it's like he gave you a slice of bread and put a slice of ham on top of it, and that's in one hand, and then in the other hand he gave you another slice of bread, and he says, I'm going to call that a ham sandwich. He's not. I think it's reasonably clear where he comes out on this, but he really was finessing things to an absurd extent. And, you know, let's face it, this presentation on his part was not dramatic. You know, it would not make for good television. It didn't make for good television. And, you know, I've observed Bob Mueller over the years, over many, many years, there's something has happened here. I don't know. I mean, I think it may be years before we'll find out what's happened, but in my experience, I've several times in my life I've dealt with members of my family who had, you know, onset dementia of some kind before they really and that I just kept thinking back to that as I watched him, you know, the uncertainty, the lack of clarity, the lack of force and his speech, all very uncharacteristic of the way this man was before. So I feel that there's a reasonable likelihood that there's some sort of health issue here.
That's just sad to hear. I was thinking the same thing, because we just did a show about dementia. And it's just it's really sad. I wanted to ask you, Scott, since you are a lawyer, when you and your lawyer friends get together and talk about this, how do you explain? I mean, maybe, like you said, maybe we will never know, or maybe not for a long time, why he decided not to charge Trump.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, I'm surprised he didn't do it and didn't press. And I think, frankly, the OLC opinions are, you know, it's not a high level of legal authority. I mean, I think he would have been well within his rights recommending aggressively some sort of action, notwithstanding the OLC opinion, and recommending aggressively that it is for Congress to decide. Now, he sort of says that, but he doesn't say that in quite the forceful way that, say, Ken Starr did. So, I mean, if we go back to Ken Starr's report, I mean, there are two or three other independent counsel reports that have been given to Congress where the independent counsel took a far more aggressive, unequivocal view about what should happen, and were far less reticent to characterize what had occurred and offer conclusions. Now, I think in this case, there's a major difference in that the statute that authorized those prior reports is no longer in force. Now we're dealing with regulations, which Neal Katyal, in fact, wrote. And we're also dealing with a figure who was appointed by the Attorney General or Deputy Attorney General, and who acts according to their guidance and direction. And one thing that's very clear about Bob Mueller and his conduct here is he takes very seriously every instruction he gets from the Attorney General and from the Deputy Attorney General. And they instructed him to be hesitant, to not go in many different areas, to refuse to discuss many subjects, and to refrain from offering conclusions on many different topics. And he adhered to all that guidance. I think, frankly, that was a mistake. He should have been more assertive in this process. And I think that will probably be, you know, I think the historical judgment of his performance in this matter, which is sort of the crown of his entire career, I don't think is going to be positive. I mean, it's not going to be, it's not going to condemn him because I think he did a professionally correct and proper job, but I think it's going to show that, you know, in the end, he just sort of faded away.
Mm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, how you doing? I've been following the case for a long time, and I listen to a lot of alternative things like the Dennis Bernstein flashpoints on KPFA and other sources like Stephen R. Cohn, who's probably the foremost authority on Russia. He's a professor emeritus from Princeton and NYU. I also happen to go to school with him in Queens. And he basically demolishes the whole idea that Russia had an influence on the election. And I have never seen anything in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or all these speakers that get on and talk about the situation that has convinced me otherwise. Also, one more thing. Robert Mueller, you know, to me, I mean, he did a very poor job in his, you know, the hearings the other day, but he has a terrible record in his work in the FBI. He helped enable the attack on Iraq and Saddam Hussein, you know, by going along with the phony thing that they had anything to do with 9/11 or that they had nuclear weapons. Plus, he's been involved after that with torturing suspects, not even convicted people, torturing in the worst way of suspects from ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So his record, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, is nothing.
Anyway, Scott, what's your response?
Well, I completely disagree with the caller on every run. I mean, Stephen Cohen, I've known for 30 years, and I don't think he's really laid a glove on any of the claims concerning the Russian involvement, which have been really very deeply documented at this point by a number of independent agencies and authorities, not just U.S. intelligence, also British, also Dutch intelligence, down to the point where we know even exactly who the officers are who were involved in doing things, the projects they were involved in, who they engaged with, the manipulation, including breaking into, as we now know, into the voter record bases of all 50 states, putting together contingency plans to attempt to manipulate the votes in several states. We don't know that, in fact, they ultimately did, but we do know they were contemplating doing all that. So, you know, I just don't think anyone can credibly deny that, although one may want to do so for political reasons. And then vis-a-vis Bob Mueller, I mean, you know, I have written, studied, and spoken about the torture issues, you know, forever and ever, and published 3 books about it and numerous articles. And one thing I can tell you for sure is that there is absolutely not one iota of evidence that links Bob Mueller to torture. And indeed, one of the most striking things is that the FBI is not involved in torture of any of these people. And some of the sharpest conflicts that occurred between FBI agents who rejected the use of torture and torture techniques and CIA people who were introducing them. So that was, you know, one of the really strong interagency conflicts that occurred back in the Bush years. He was also absolutely uninvolved in building or making the case for going to war with Iraq. Of course, he was a member of the Bush administration. The Bush administration did all those things. He can be tarred for that. That's, you know, fine and good. I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, certainly I disagree with a lot of the details of the question.
Well, we're going to do a show about election security. We only have a few more minutes left, but I was reading a piece called America is Missing Its Chance to Fix Our Election System Before 2020 by Steven Rosenfeld, who's with Voting Booth, and he writes that the Mueller report said that election administration computers in at least one Florida county government had been hacked. And then there's this New York Times piece. A number of outlets are reporting on this. Just yesterday, Russia targeted election systems in all 50 states. And then this deserves a lot more attention. The Hill, I'm reading from The Hill now. This piece just came out a few days ago. Senate Republicans blocked two election security bills and a cybersecurity measure on Wednesday. Democrats tried to get consent to pass two bills that would require campaigns to alert the Federal Election Commission about foreign offers of assistance, as well as a bill to the Senate Sergeant at Arms to offer voluntary cyber assistance for devices and accounts. But Cindy Hyde Smith, a Republican from Mississippi, blocked each of these bills without giving any reason. So can you talk about the significance of this, Scott? This deserves a lot more attention.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, it's an emerging meme today. I see Moscow Mitch coming up everywhere as an issue. Mitch McConnell personally intervened to block putting some of this on the floor of the Senate and allowing a vote on it yesterday. So I think this should be one of the two or three biggest political issues in the country. Voting security is a huge issue, and the mechanics of voting security. So we made a huge movement to electric tabulation, electric voting, without a paper trail. And if you look at the way governments in other parts of the world are responding to this crisis, and this is a crisis in all Western democracies, what you see is consistent. They're all going back to paper ballots marked with a pencil or marker, hand-tabulated, and so forth, going back to systems that have been in place since the 19th century and work, because electronics, there's no way you can do an electronic system that isn't hackable or manipulable. Just can't be done.
Yeah. Well, we will definitely do a show about this, and we will also do a show about the troll farm that you mentioned. The Daily Beast has an interesting story called "Is the Infamous Russian Troll Farm Pushing Deadly LGBT Hate?" And that's in the Daily Beast. Thank you so much for joining us, Scott. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. You can find more information about these stories at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar at Your Call.